Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here we are. You should be able to see the mountains. You should be able to see our beautiful city, but you can't see anything. And it's destroying not only our health, but our economy. From 50 to 70% of the junk that's in the air comes from our own cars, mine and yours. We've got to tune up those engines. We've got to have them inspected. If all of our cars were operating efficiently, we would have a significant reduction in all of this pollution and junk that's in the air.
That's L.A. City Councilman Marvin Browdy way back in 1979, almost 40 years ago. Our cars are much cleaner now, but we still have a smog problem. That's probably not news to any of you listening. We're going to talk about that later in the show. But first, a different kind of story about our local environment. Yesterday, the City Planning Commission approved a huge controversial development project for South L.A. It's called The Reef. It would bring more than 1,000 apartments and condos, a grocery store, and retail to a part of the city that so far has been largely left out of LA's development boom. But not everyone is happy about it. Many community activists say this kind of project is a harbinger for gentrification and displacement. Renee Dake Wilson is a planning commissioner. She's also an architect, and she's here to talk about yesterday's hearing and decision. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Tell us a little bit more about the look of the proposal for The Reef, if you could paint a picture for us of the grand plan.
Okay, well, it's a building designed by Gensler Architects. It's got a modern design. As you said in your introduction, it's got 1,444 housing units. Some of those are condos and some of them are rentals. There's a small hotel, a parking structure. It's on the LA Mart site, the current LA Mart, which they've rebranded as The Reef and have redeveloped that site as well. On the ground floor of the existing Reef building and on these new projects, which are two city blocks in South Los Angeles off Washington Street, there's some retail, including a grocery store, pharmacy, restaurants, some other retail, and also some small business incubator sites. There's a good amount of open space, which is required open space by the number of housing units. They're not doing anything out of extra there. And also, additionally, on the project, they proposed a very large sign district and digital signage.
So, multi-use, big project going up, 1,400 apartments and condos, and there's debate about whether some of those should be set aside for low-income residents, right? And on its face, that sounds like a no-brainer. This is a low-income neighborhood, South L.A. What's the counter-argument?
Well, I think the counter-argument is that the project wouldn't get built, which is maybe not a bad thing to some people. Yesterday at Planning Commission, we did add 5% low-income affordable housing and reduce the sign district to have no digital, as well as some community-friendly modifications that we put to really make sure that this project knows that it can welcome the existing community. But the existing site right now is two empty parking lots with nothing going on. There's no pedestrian life there. And it's right near a lot of transit, pedestrian, bicycle. The My Figueroa project is five blocks west. The Blue Line metro station is nearby in walking distance, as are several bus lines. So having no direct displacement on a site of two parking lots, I can't say I'm going to miss surface parking in Los Angeles.
Well, who is the developer and how's their record stack up? How can you even be sure that they'll abide by the 5% low-income housing rule?
Well, they would have to with their entitlement that they get from the city. This is bound in their approvals from the city. Certainly, this project has to get through council still. additional to the project that we approved yesterday, working with Councilmember Curran Price of CD9, where the project sits, there was a requirement for $15 million in affordable housing funds. So while we required 5% low-income affordable housing on site, $15 million for affordable housing in Council District 9 was also approved. Those would be used to extend the term of existing affordable housing sites and also for new projects.
Well, you just had a very contentious meeting yesterday. Some protesters were forcibly removed from the building. Why don't you describe how that went down and what people from the neighborhood were most concerned about in this development?
You know, we really saw, we had over 2 hours of testimony, or just about 2 hours of testimony from public comment. So that's about a minute or two for all those people. The room was packed, and it was incredibly emotional. There were people from the neighborhood mostly for and against the project. So there were several people saying, please come invest in our neighborhood. Bring me a grocery store. Get rid of these blighted parking lots. Give me a place where I can go with my children on, you know, nearby and give money to our neighborhood. Additionally, in that development agreement, there was $3 million for those community groups. So soccer teams and outreach groups in the neighborhood that was negotiated by Curran Price. So those groups were for the project.
And on the other side?
Yeah, there were very vocal protesters against the project. Some people bringing up Black Lives Matter and talking about displacement in the neighborhood, and they were very vocal and chanting. And at sometimes their chanting, which we were very sympathetic to, it didn't allow us to do our business and really disrupted our business. And yesterday, you know, they stopped others from being able to speak because it took up a lot of time and we couldn't hear what was going on. So we had to, you know, we could hear what they were saying. Obviously, the message got across. It was incredibly emotional. But eventually, we did have to eject them from the meeting so we could have a conversation about what was appropriate for the site.
Right. And the commission has ultimately approved the project yesterday. How did you feel about it? Were you torn about this? And we should put this in context for our listeners that the planning commissioners, they're volunteers. You're a volunteer. Your decisions are not binding for the city council. So this is only a recommendation.
Correct. And I'm incredibly torn about this project. I worked for a year to try to get this developer to put affordable housing on this site behind the scenes. I'm negotiating with council members in the mayor's office. And in the end, those elected officials and the developer really felt like that would not allow the project to get built, that there hasn't been investment in South Los Angeles, that it's going to be difficult to finance the project. So while I'm incredibly sympathetic, I pushed for development on the site and allowing the 1,444 housing units to get built on an empty lot during a housing crisis. We have only 2.7% vacancy, depending on which numbers you listen to. So we need more housing, especially in a low-income unit, in a low-income area. There should be a component of affordable housing. There's no doubt.
Renee Dake Wilson, she's an architect and city planning commissioner. And thank you so much. It was good to talk with you today. Thanks for filling us in.
Okay.
Well, do you have an opinion about the project or others like it? You can leave us a voicemail at 844-PRESS-PLAY or leave us a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Well, South LA has made great strides when it comes to gang violence over the last several decades, and one tool in the belt of law enforcement is a database called CalGang. It's supposed to be a place where cops can cross-check the names of people in custody or suspects with a list of known gang members. Supposed to, I said. But the database is deeply flawed, according to a state audit out this week. There are unverified entries, out-of-date information, and some of the information is just plain wrong. And this can have far-reaching consequences, because immigration officials use the data to deport undocumented people, people who may never have had gang ties in the U.S. Ali Winston is an independent reporter covering criminal justice and surveillance. His story on gang databases appears in The Intercept. Welcome, Ali.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. So you start your story with a man that you call Carlos, not his real name, and about how he got caught up in the ICE gang database. Why don't you tell us about Carlos and what happened to him?
So Carlos is a Central American man. He's in his mid-30s right now. He's from Guatemala. When he was a teenager in Guatemala City, he and his brother joined a local faction of MS-13 that they claim they did just to hang out with their friends. He fled Guatemala after being shot a number of times and tortured by law enforcement during anti-gang operations. And he's had family members murdered down there as well, and he fears for his life. So he came to the U.S. in the late 90s, early 2000s, and didn't have any contact with law enforcement until he was stopped and his old tattoos, his homemade tattoos, were documented by LAPD in the areas around MacArthur Park. His information was then inputted into the state's gang database. Years later, once Immigration and Customs Enforcement set up their own database along the lines of CalGang, his information was noticed by them, and then he was placed in removal proceedings. He beat that based on an appeal on the previous injuries and torture he'd suffered at the hands of police in Guatemala, but he's one of an untold number of people who have been placed in this situation by unverified gang allegations.
Well, how do you end up as defined as a gang associate? What's the threshold for putting someone in one of these databases?
There are a number of criteria that, at least on a state level, can lead to somebody being entered into a gang database. The feds have not released their criteria for classifying somebody as a gang member, but I'm told that they're very similar to California's requirements. It's any combination of self-admission, having gang-related tattoos, wearing gang-related clothing, being seen in a gang-related neighborhood, associating with known gang members, or having a confidential informant say, oh, this guy's, he's associated with this gang.
And this database set up by ICE, this federal database for the immigration services, it's called ICE Gang. Why is ICE in the business of tracking gangs in the first place?
Back in the mid-2000s, ICE put into place an initiative called Operation Community Shield that was designed to counter what was seen as the rising influence of Central American gangs in the United States that were made up of a significant number of undocumented immigrants. This is a hotly contested matter for over a decade now. But as part of this initiative, ICE set up a gang database along the lines of the system that California created in the mid-1990s. That system that California pioneered is now in use by 13 other states, as well as the FBI and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. It's important to note, though, that with the exception of juveniles in California, nobody who's on a gang database has any right to know that they have such a file on them or a right to review that information in the entire country.
So you can be on one and you won't know it. Is there any data or is there any sense of how many people are in this combined gang database who were former gang members like Carlos but are now no longer in gangs?
ICE has not released any numbers whatsoever to me pursuant to a Freedom of Information request about how large their database is. I can tell you that California's database currently holds around 150,000 people. Over 80% of them are Black or Latino, but it's at least hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, what happens to people who are deported under these circumstances when they arrive in their countries of origin? Does the database information just follow them there?
What I've been told happens is that when a suspected or when an alleged gang member is removed from the United States, the authorities in the U.S. will send a Interpol notice to the local authorities that, hey, we're sending this person back to you. They're a documented gang member. They could be a threat to public safety, so on and so forth, which in Central America is a problem because there have been many, many reports about the heavy-handed response of authorities in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras to alleged gang members. There's a huge gang problem down there. Central America has some of the most violent cities in the world. But at the same time, the way that the police conduct themselves down there, I mean, there have been reports, Human Rights Watch reports and so forth, documenting cases of summary execution by law enforcement for people who are just suspected of gang ties or in certain gang neighborhoods.
Well, as you said, Carlos was able to beat his charge, but I gather a lot of other people aren't, and this gang affiliation can follow you into the courts. Is there any awareness in the courts by judges that this information might follow someone through the system and it might not be right?
I think the questions about accuracy, the accuracy of gang allegations have been swirling for some time. Carlos was lucky because he got a very good lawyer who challenged his removal and was able to get his documentation and prove that what ICE was claiming about him actually wasn't true. I will say, though, that in immigration court, you have no right to representation. You have no right to review the evidence presented against you. You know, you're really at a disadvantage because it's not criminal law. It's a sort of administrative law. It's a very peculiar quirk of the immigration system. But it has been exacerbated. This lack of due process has been exacerbated by the push over the past decade, two decades, to remove people seen as threats to public safety in the U.S. through administrative law rather than dealing with them in criminal law.
Well, who's raising questions about these gang databases? We've had this audit here in California, but what about nationwide?
I think immigrants' rights advocates have protested against Operation Community Shield for years and against the Obama and the Bush, the George W. Bush administration's policies of mass removal, but the gang database is not really ICE's use of unverified gang information has come up on, I think, a very case-by-case basis, but it's not, you know, this is not an issue that's really hit the headlines yet.
And has ICE responded to your reporting?
They wouldn't respond to requests for comment. I spoke to some former officials. I got some information from them about the raw statistics that they were able to give me about certain arrests, but they're very tight-lipped when it comes to stuff like this.
Ali Winston, he's an independent journalist covering criminal justice, surveillance, and privacy, and his story on gang databases appeared in The Intercept. Thanks so much for this.
Thank you.
Coming up, LA's air pollution is worse this summer, and people are feeling it. How air pollution kills, and why California stands to gain the most of any state in the country by cleaning up our act. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's Friday. Take a deep breath. Well, wait. Actually, don't do that. The air quality in Southern California hasn't been this bad in years, and it's not going to get much better in the coming weeks. Plus, there's this alarming fact from a new study. Thousands of deaths in the Southern California region could be prevented every year if the air quality was better. And this region, more than any other in the nation, has the most to gain in terms of lives saved if we do clean up our air. We have Tony Barboza from the LA Times on the line. He covers air quality and the environment, and it's good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the study, how bad has the air been this summer?
Well, what we've seen this year has been a noticeable uptick in the number of bad air days, and we've seen the actual levels of pollution going up, too, over the previous years. Some of the levels have been the highest we've seen since 2009. Now, it's not anything compared to what people might remember back in the 70s and 80s when you had thick, really terrible smog, but it is kind of a step backward in that progress.
Right. Back then, you could barely find your car when you'd parked it more than 10 feet away. Now, you called around to some hospitals. What are people saying there?
Yeah, what we're seeing and what we learned through interviews is that hospitals, especially in the Inland Empire area where the pollution is highest, they've actually seen an uptick in patients. So they're seeing people coming to emergency rooms with in distress with asthma symptoms flaring up. They're seeing a noticeable increase over the last two months compared to the year before.
And how does air pollution cause death? What do people die of?
Yeah, it's interesting. The way it works, actually, is poor air quality is a contributor to deaths that wouldn't otherwise occur. So what you see is when the air pollution jumps, people with asthma and chronic diseases and other health problems, they actually are kind of pushed over the edge by the poor air quality. And that results in deaths that just wouldn't occur if the air were cleaner.
So it's a final straw.
Right, kind of being like the tipping point.
Now, when we talk about air pollution, we're talking about two different things, right?
Yeah, in Southern California, you kind of have two smog seasons. You have the summer smog season, which is driven by ozone pollution, and that's a corrosive, lung-irritating gas that builds up in the air. And then in the winter, you tend to have more fine particle pollution. That's kind of the soot-type air pollution that's brown and those are actual particles that can get are really harmful because they can get deep into the lungs.
And in just speaking to the ozone pollution, is there consensus on why it's so high this year? And apparently it's not so much in our control.
Yeah, if you talk to the air quality regulators for the region, they'll tell you that it's largely a factor of the weather, that we've had some of our strongest inversion layers, you know, these weather patterns that trap air and pollution close to the ground, those have been especially strong. And then we've got high heat, and heat really favors the formation of ozone. But you talk to some people in, you know, environmental advocates, health advocates, they say, well, you know what, we shouldn't have to depend on the weather for clean air, and that really these air quality regulators should be adopting more aggressive emissions standards and more tougher regulations to avoid this kind of thing from happening.
Well, the backdrop to this story is that there's been a big to-do about the South Coast Air Quality Management District, that it's changed the makeup of its board earlier this year, and environmentalists and health officials are furious about it. What's been going on there?
Yeah, the Air Quality Management District, which is a powerful agency that regulates air quality across four Southern California counties, they have undergone a political shift lately. Earlier this year, Republicans took over a majority of seats on the Air Quality Board and fired their longtime executive officer. Since then, they've been pursuing what you would call more industry-friendly approaches to regulation. So just recently, there was an air quality plan put out that has kind of faced some criticism and skepticism from environmentalists because it relies heavily on incentive, you know, funding that would pay businesses to reduce pollution rather than, you know, strict rules that would force them to do it.
And has the Air Quality Board, have they responded to any of the outrage that's been directed at it?
Oh, well, you know, I go to most every Air Quality Board meeting, and, you know, they're very lively lately. You have environmental activists from the Inland Empire, which is, of course, the smoggiest region. They've been stridently, you know, opposing a lot of these moves by the Air Quality Board. And then you have members, you know, the chairman of the board and different, you know, it's mostly local elected officials. You've got them defending their actions and saying, hey, you know, we've cleaned up the air tremendously over the last several decades, and we're going to continue to do so. Some of the officials have denied that they intend to roll back pollution regulations at all.
Well, let's get to this study from NYU and the American Thoracic Society, which showed that when it comes to the Southern California region, we have the most to gain compared to the rest of the country if we do clean up our air. Why is that?
Yeah, it's largely a function of Southern California having the nation's worst air quality and a huge population breathing all that air. So, yeah, what their study did, it was really interesting. It looked at what would happen if the Southern California region, and actually compared it to places all around the country, said what would happen if we were to clean the air beyond current health standards to make it even cleaner. And what they found that was across the country, you would save thousands of lives a year of premature, you know, from premature deaths, and that about a third of those, you know, well over 3,000 of those deaths would avoidable deaths are in California, most of them in Southern California.
So when it comes down to it, it's all about us being big.
It's about you know, big population, nation's worst pollution. You combine those, and you have a whole lot of people affected by, you know, whose lives and their lifespans really are affected by exposure to that polluted air.
Oh, I'm wondering then, what's the moral of the story of this study? I mean, we knew air is bad and that there's a real cost in health already. Is there anything to really sit up and take notice in
well,
this
I think,
news?
You know, this is a study that comes from a group of medical professionals across the country. And in this debate over where to set air quality standards, which, you know, comes up periodically as the Environmental Protection Agency makes those decisions, you know, nationwide, they've been some of the, these health groups have been some of the strongest advocates for tighter standards. They say that, you know, as far as environmental issues go, there's few that have such a solid connection to people's well-being, you know, the quality of life and just their respiratory health. So they've been very strident in saying that we need stronger standards that reflect the latest science. And, you know, this is another kind of another piece of evidence in that argument that not only would we see clearer vistas and, you know, we would also just see people living longer. And that evidence has actually played out. You know, there are previous studies that show that, you know, years of reductions in air pollution have made people's lives longer, reduced other, asthma, cardiovascular disease, and other illnesses.
Well, thanks for this. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Tony Barbosa, he covers air quality and the environment for the LA Times. Coming up, we go to the movies for a sausage party, cowboy bank robbers, a flying dragon, and a woman who can't sing. And she does it so beautifully.
I just thought that this woman is like the greatest example of what we should all be. And who better to play her than Meryl Streep? She's magic.
Friday Movies next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Press Play, a Barbara Bogavid for Madeline Brand. It's Friday, and that means it's time to look at this weekend's movies. Today, we'll take a look at sex comedy about food, or is it a food comedy about sex, or a food comedy about religion? I don't know. We're also going to be talking about a terrible opera singer and an animated dragon and mustached bank robbers with Tim Grierson and Gray Drake. I just ran them all together there, but we shall manage to separate them, right, Tim and Gray?
You bet.
Tim is a senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a film critic for The New Republic. And Gray is senior editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Great to have you here.
Hi there. What a week.
I know. We've got to get started because we have so many movies to pack in here. Let's start with The Sausage Party. It's a surprisingly grown-up and well-reviewed animated movie about where food thinks it goes when it dies and where it really goes.
Oh, yes. I'm the first to enter eternity.
Oh, potato! Way to go, buddy!
The pipes are coming. Oh, Jesus! Oh, gummy skin! She's peeling me.
Stop!
I thought this wouldn't play on radio, but it's actually great on radio.
I've been waiting my whole life to hear hamburgers scream.
And this is, you can tell from all of the bleeps, this is clearly not a kid's movie. But what is it anyway?
It's from the same guys who did This Is the End, Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen. Yes, it's very much an animated movie for grown-ups.
It's a sausage fest of a movie.
Yes, and it's kind of a parody of Pixar in certain ways. And it's about, as you described, it's a world where grocery store food thinks that when it's selected by the gods, which are human beings like you and me, that they will go to the great beyond. So everybody wants to be chosen to go to the great beyond. the movie is about when they realize that's not what happens, actually. And so, kind of like a Pixar movie, it's a quest. Seth Rogen voices a sausage who goes across the grocery store with his girlfriend, who is a hot dog bun, played by Kristen Wiig. And it's, you know, this has been, I think, a pretty terrible summer in terms of big blockbusters.
That is true. Nothing to see. That's true.
This is a movie, well, for grown-ups anyway, this is a movie to see. I find it really, really funny. And I think what it does that Seth Rogen's movies do when they're really good is that they're really crass, they push the line, but underneath there's actually a certain amount of smarts and heart to them.
And some big ideas, right? I mean, we're talking about religion and humans being false gods and 40 virgins waiting for you at the end comes to mind.
What's really funny, all of that is in the movie. And also I think what's really great is this idea of if you've been kind of taught a certain orthodoxy, how do you break out of that when certain people just want to believe what they've been told, even if it's not true? I think what's really great, though, about Sausage Party is that even though all that stuff is in there, it's not done in such a way where it feels really heavy-handed. What you walk out of this movie thinking is, I can't believe they said this. I can't believe they got away with this. This part was hilarious and so wrong. And then afterward, you think, there was actually kind of a really smart message in there at the same time. This movie is really, really funny.
Well, I love the arguing between a lavash bread and a bagel and any movie with sectarian conflict between two bread products.
Yeah, this is the movie that allows Edward Norton to do his Woody Allen impression really, really well. He plays a Jewish bagel in the movie. Kind of across the board, the voice cast is really, really great in this.
Well, as much as I don't want to move on, we have to move on to a much more mannered comedy. Lawrence Foster Jenkins is based on a true story. It's a movie starring Meryl Streep as a society woman who took the opera house by storm with her terrible singing.
She can't be a little flat.
Flat?
Just a tad.
The lady is a lesson in courage, and that's why we love her.
Bravo, funny.
And all the reviews are just terrific.
Yeah? Ours is a very happy world.
We're jiggerbug.
That was what Florence would have called it, because
jiggerbugging instead of jitterbugging.
Anything except hitting the perfect note is what Florence was really known for. And as a real life character, this woman is completely magical, right? She's a terrible singer, but in the middle of World War II was bringing art and music to the people because of her great bank account and her love of music.
Right. She had a lot of money, right? She loved music, and her husband indulged her and shielded her from anyone telling her just how terrible she was. But it's kind of a disturbing story, you know, when I heard it, that this guy kind of keeps his wife in a bubble.
Yeah, you know, that's the line that this movie walks, because Florence also loves to sing, but she's awful. And when you YouTube the real Florence, you're laughing at her, and she's awful. But at the same time, it's her passion that really shines through and really captured everyone's enthusiasm.
But does the movie capture just how interesting the real Florence Foster Jenkins was?
I believe so. I didn't know Florence's story when I saw it. And I just thought that this woman is like the greatest example of what we should all be. And who better to play her than Meryl Streep? She's magic. This movie's filled with hope and inspiration. It felt like such a break from all of the frustrating things in our world.
I didn't like it quite as much. I do like the movie. You know, the walking the line that Gray talks about. I actually wished it would walk a little closer to that line. Because for me, the one thing, and I think Barbara, you kind of talked about this a little bit, is that it's about a woman who is a beautiful spirit and has such love for music and wants to share that with other people, but she's terrible, just absolutely awful.
And a figure of fun, and she doesn't know it.
Yeah, and the question that's interesting in the movie that I wish they explored a little more is Hugh Grant plays her second husband, who has a mistress on the side. He loves her, but he's not in love with her. There's very much a sense that he is with her because she is so rich, but he still cares about her and wants to protect her. And the problem, my one reservation I guess I have with the movie is that I wish it was a little more about why are we attracted to awful talent sometimes? Because what's interesting in the movie is that there's two groups of people. There's one group who think, oh, she's awful, I have to go see her perform. And then there's another group that really responds to the unvarnished authenticity of a person who's just trying but isn't very good. And I think that throughout the years, we've always had kind of talents that are like that. But that being said, this movie is very much a crowd pleaser. It's not trying to be that movie. And so I acknowledge the fact that it works well, but it did make me kind of crave maybe a little more of an incisive kind of look at the world that Stephen Frears, the director, creates.
Gotcha, and he can be so good at that more subtle exploration. Well, moving on, next up is a Disney remake of the 1977 real-life meets animation fable called Pete's Dragon.
Elliot.
I feel like I'm on a Disneyland ride, right?
I think that's what they were going for.
Especially in that trailer, that's what they're going for, yes.
Okay, well, what are we talking about here? Because this was an original film that maybe many of our listeners never saw.
Well, and notable, certainly, for its 2D animation combined with live action. But do we also remember that it was not good?
I remember
cheesy
that.
Cheesy.
I remember that, yes. Yeah. Yes. For 1977 and not okay, but not great.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they finally have figured out you should remake movies that are bad and then make them good. And Disney did it.
Finally.
Oh, my God. This movie is a delight. It made me furious with the villain. It made me excited about the existence of magic. I just felt like a child watching this movie about a little kid who gets lost in the woods and raised by an imaginary dragon.
Oh, Tim, you're laughing?
Yeah,
yes?
Yeah,
no?
I also liked it. I think what works for the movie, but also can be a little bit of a problem, is that it is very consciously an old-fashioned family film.
Yeah. And what do we mean by that?
There's no snark.
Mm-mm.
I mean, it's sort of set in an unspecified late 1970s, early 1980s period, so that even that makes it feel old-fashioned. But it's a movie that doesn't have snark. There aren't big action sequences. There aren't, like, the type of kind of cheap jokes that we get in a lot of kids' movies, like fart humor and things like that. And so in that way,
okay, now it sounds like the best movie ever made.
And so it's really refreshing in that way. The one thing I would say is that it is a little bit, it almost leans too hard on, look how much we're making kind of an old-fashioned kind of movie. It's almost a little too self-conscious in that way. It doesn't have, I think, like, the dragon and a lot of that stuff. The relationship between Pete and the dragon are great. Some of the other stuff feels a little bit more like, do you see that we're making a movie that's not contemporary and is more of a throwback?
I get it. The dragon has fur, not scales. That seems fascinating.
Yeah, he's very dog-like.
Very much so.
And so in a lot of ways, this movie is kind of a throwback to the old boy and his dog kind of movies. I will say that since you can't take your kids to Sausage Party, this is the type of movie that I think a lot of adults, like parents, will appreciate and think, oh, thank you for not talking down to my child. Actually, thank you for having a certain amount of intelligence and treating my children with intelligence and not just bludgeoning them with sound and fury and special effects and like that.
Well, let's go from a forest fairy tale to a gritty, modern West Texas Western and a movie called Hell or High Water. It's about two brothers robbing banks for a good cause.
You know, the bank loan, just enough to keep your mama poor. Thought they could swipe her land.
It's a big bank.
It's too big.
That's what she said.
Now they can foreclose on Friday. So come hell or high water,
get the money to the bank on Thursday.
And then you are free and clear.
They fit a lot into that little exchange.
Sure did. Yeah, sure did, ma'am.
A sex joke. Big Bang reference. So this movie has such a great cast. Ben Foster and Chris Pine as the bank robbing brothers, right? And Jeff Bridges as the Texas Ranger who's chasing them. What do you think?
I'm the world's most positive broken record this week because I loved it. It's another great movie.
We should just tape that and we can just, because I loved it.
I gotta tell you, Chris Pine and Ben Foster are such a good pair together. It's such a simple and elegant movie. And being pursued as bank robbers by Jeff Bridges it's like, what a great equation. And it's so, so Texas. I mean that in the best way possible.
Oh, they nail the Texas angle? Tim?
Yeah. Yeah, and also, yeah, I did too. And it's a Scottish filmmaker, David McKenzie, who made it. And especially, like you were saying, Gray, about the Texasness of it, it really gets all of that right.
You can smell the barbecue.
You can smell the barbecue, but it's not done in a way where it's like, it feels authentic as opposed to a person who's trying really hard to make it all Texas-y. It feels authentic. I've been a big Chris Pine fan for a while and sort of saying, like, no, I think he's actually not just charismatic. I think he actually has like a real amount of depth. I think he definitely does in this. Ben Foster kind of does his Ben Foster thing that he always does, but I like it.
It works here.
Yeah, it really is. It's the type of thing where, like, when you give Ben Foster the right role, he kills it. He can do it better than anybody else. And he's really, really good, I think, in this movie.
Well, maybe this movie is all about casting, but there are a lot of shots of the wonderful rusted out American West and jabs at banks from both the good and the bad guys. Do you think it works as political commentary as well?
I do. It wasn't too heavy-handed while still being really emotionally moving. And they hit all the right notes and beats while making it an exciting action movie, too. So it just was a nice balance, all in a bunch of cowboy boots with dust swirling around. Romantic somehow. It's also because I miss living in Texas.
Well, I want to dwell right in that image, and yeah. We'll leave it there. Gray Drake, she's senior editor at Rotten Tomatoes, and Tim Grierson, he's senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a film critic for The New Republic. Thank you both for coming in. It was a joy.
Thank you.
Yeehaw.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogaven for Madeline Brand. Season 6 of HBO's Game of Thrones wrapped back in June, and the finale, spoiler alert, Jon Snow took his place as king in the North. Cersei established herself as queen of the Seven Kingdoms, and Daenerys headed Cersei's way with 1,000 ships in tow and her dragons overhead, perfectly setting up a possibly epic showdown between houses next season, and so many thousands of us cannot wait. There's theories about what happens. They're bounding online. But Game of Thrones is that all too rare great serial drama these days that leaves fans on pins and needles in anticipation for next season, season after season. And that's why many shows now are trying different models. And anthology series are on the rise. Here to tell us what that is, Matt Zoller-Seitz. He wrote about it recently. He's TV critic for New York Magazine. Good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me.
So define the term. What is an anthology series?
Well, what an anthology series used to mean was every time you tuned in, you saw a completely different story. Just like if you, in the old days, you would read a magazine and there would be a short story by Dorothy Parker and a short story by John Updike, and maybe they would have a common theme, but that was as far as it went. And The Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, shows like that are examples of what we used to think of when we said anthology. Now the unit of measure is increasingly the season. And shows like American Horror Story, American Crime Story, American Crime, a lot of Americans in this thing, Fargo, True Detective, they tell a story for a season, and then that story is over, and the next season they'll have new characters, a new plot, new setting probably. It's over in 8 hours or 10 hours or 6 hours or however long, but that's it. So it's almost like they're putting out a series of novels on similar themes.
And does it work better as a comedy or a drama, or maybe a dramedy?
Well, it's most of these things are dramas. They're dramas. Some of them are funny. I think Fargo is a very funny show, but ultimately it's a drama as well. And it's a great format because it allows the people who write and produce the show to not have to worry about how are we going to sustain this thing for 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, however many years that it runs. And they also don't run into that problem that a lot of shows run into, which is you have a good run. You have like good 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years, and then you start to sag. You start to sag in 6, 7, 8, and by the time you get to 9 or 10, everybody's kind of tired of you. And if there's a devastatingly bad season, which a lot of series have, even good ones, they don't have to worry about recovering. If you know, American Horror Story is a great example of that. Season one, nobody knew it was an anthology series. They just knew that every week they killed off a character, and then they got to the end and there was only a couple of characters left and they killed them too, and that's how you knew it was an anthology.
I know, it's a really slow burn there.
It was incredible. And I remember, if
God forbid, you got attached to any of those characters.
Well, if you go back and read my recaps, I was recapping that thing for Salon. I get increasingly distressed by the week. It's like I'm distressed for the show. Like, how are they going to keep this going? But also because they keep killing off all the characters, and I guess like, how are they going to have a season two? And the answer is they weren't. And then there was American Horror Story Asylum, which was the best of the two. But 3, 4, and 5 have been pretty bad. Pretty
I know.
Bad.
You were really getting nervous. I was concerned for your mental health.
I was. Yeah. I think in one of my recaps, I compared it to that Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny cartoon where they're competing to see who can get the bigger laugh from a bigger applause from the crowd. And finally, Daffy swallows an entire can of gasoline and a match and blows himself up. And Bugs says, "I got to hand it to you there's no way I can top that." And he says, and Daffy says, "You're right, but the only problem is I can only do that once."
But I have to come back with some logic here. Orange is the New Black. It's sustained. What? How many seasons now? 5?
Where are we? Oh, yeah, yeah.
House of Cards was a keeper, too. I mean, the long-form serial drama, it's hardly dead.
Oh, I'm not saying that there's no examples of traditional serialized dramas that can keep it going. I'm just saying it's always been hard. I don't think it's any easier. If anything, I think it's harder now because there's so much television to choose from. I'm a television critic, and I can't keep track of all the good shows, let alone the mediocre shows, the bad shows. There are some mediocre and bad ones that I keep track of because I want to be part of the conversation around those shows, but it's just impossible. I mean, if I cloned myself 6 times, I still couldn't watch all the scripted stuff on TV. And think about how, then I think about, well, where's the average viewer in all of this? Like a person who's not.
Oh, we are so oppressed.
Job.
We are so oppressed. I feel it. I feel it hanging over me, all of the TV I'd like to watch.
It's
and
ridiculous.
I think, I wonder if that's what this is all about, like getting some kind of control over your world. It's not just fiction. There's so much news coming at you. These anthologies, it's so easy to sit down and just watch them in a clump, binge watch, and whoosh.
It's great.
I know
it's
they're going to be good.
It's great, yeah. And the binge watching, I think, has also helped, too, because you know that if House of Cards comes out, there's, say, 10 episodes. Each of them runs an hour. That's a show that doesn't usually go over. You can say, all right, that's a 10-hour commitment. When am I going to do that? Maybe you do it the first weekend. Maybe you wait for a month or 2 months or 6 months, but it's always going to be there. It just makes a little more sense. And there are a few shows on the air. Game of Thrones is certainly one of them. I think that Walking Dead, Scandal maybe, are others, where people feel like they need to watch it every week when it airs, like the really hardcore fans do. But increasingly I find that people who read me tell me this, that it's not that they don't have the time, it's just that they choose not to use their time in that particular way. They would rather know, okay, there's 2 seasons of Fargo. They're both different stories. Each of them runs 12 hours or 13 hours, however many. Maybe I'll watch one of those someday. That's a very different proposition than saying, how long has Grey's Anatomy been on? All right, I guess I'll keep watching.
That's a very different TV or more popular culture experience, though, to be one of the people who's really into a series. I'm really into The Wire. It gives you an identity. And I think that's the joy of those serialized, the traditional serialized, Mad Men, Sopranos-type television.
Well,
I don't think it's something I want to give up.
No, and it certainly is more. I think it is more pleasurable in certain ways to absorb a story. I think you can absorb the story more when it is released in chapters of once per week. That's been pretty standard up until pretty recently, and I think there's still room for that kind of thing. I think the problem is that television as a whole is suffering from its increasing inability to get people to sit down at a particular time on a particular night and watch a show.
Well, sure, but here we have Mr. Robot, really great first season,
mm-hmm.
and second season has been uneven. Is this just about not very great writing, or is this a serial, a traditional kind of format that might work out for them in season 3?
I think it's very rare that the writers of a show have a sense of how to sustain it over the course of 4 to 8 or more years. more often they're kind of making things up as they go. And a lot of times, and I tell you, a lot of times when I review these shows when they're new, the complaint that I have, even if I like the show, it's I'm not convinced that there's enough here to merit a show as opposed to a miniseries or a movie. That's the number one concern I have with most TV, even the TV I like, is, yes, I like this season a lot, or I like these two seasons a lot, but is there really enough story here for eight seasons? I think in the question of something like a Mad Men or The West Wing, even though it had problems in its last couple of years, The X-Files even, you know, that had a sort of a fallow stretch. I think, yeah, there is, but a lot of other shows, I don't know. And I think
there's really only one show that has that kind of depth, and that's Angie Tribeca. Am I right?
Oh, you know, it's funny. Somebody, a friend of mine keeps urging me unironically to write a book appreciating Gilligan's Island.
I think there is one.
Stranger things have been suggested.
Well, good luck with that. Matt Zollersites, who wrote about this recently, Anthology Television. He's TV critic for New York Magazine and editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. A pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Julie.
Hello.
Hi. What are people saying, thinking, tweeting?
Today.
Posting.
Well, I'm thinking that I appreciate the British paradigm of three episodes, like 3 hour and a half episodes. How
Wait, what are you thinking
digestible?
Of? I love Luther, Black Mirror, but that's...
Luther, Black Mirror, yeah. Really good. Yeah. Netflix is developing a new season of that as well, which is excellent. That's my favorite because I am one of those people who I will watch a TV show for a weekend and then forget that I ever saw it and will never revisit it again. So that is the best for me.
For the amnesia model.
Right. From TV to movies, Jeff Stevens was outraged about our characterization of Pete's Dragon, the original 1970s Pete's Dragon, as a terrible movie.
Wow, I didn't think that would provoke outrage.
That's the outrage of the day. He says that it helped to make him appreciate musicals as a kid. Its style and tone as a musical follows the same pattern of the Menken and Ashman animated films that revitalized the company a decade later. He would take that razzle-dazzle any day of the week.
Well, fair enough. Listen, thank you for that. Thank all of you for listening, and thanks for this week. I will be out of here come Monday. Madeline Brand will be back. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.